Wisconsin Eyes and Wisconsin Dells at the 2017 Republican State Convention, and we're fortunate enough to be interviewing Senator Ron Johnson. Senator, welcome to the convention, which you're the chair of.
Well, welcome as well.
Can we talk about health care?
Sure.
I remember the first time I interviewed you, you told that very poignant story about your daughter and how she had to have emergency heart surgery. Mm-hmm. Your daughter now, doesn't she have a pre-existing condition? Mm-hmm. And throughout her life, how is Congress going to fix Obamacare in a way that she and others with pre-existing condition are not only going to have access to it, but be able to afford it, sir?
Well, just real quick update on the story. My daughter's now 34 years old.
Please do.
She's the mother of a beautiful little baby girl, 18-month-old little granddaughter.
Grandpa.
And by the way, I'm just, brand-new grandpa, my third grandchild, second grandson. So, that's why we do these things.
Obviously. She has a pre-existing condition.
You know, so many people do.
Yes.
The problem is that Obamacare recognized that and didn't fix the problem. They made it worse by forcing insurance companies to sell a policy to somebody at any point in time, basically. There's some enrollment periods, but not particularly well enforced. They're basically collapsing these insurance markets. And the analogy I would use is if you could buy an auto insurance policy at any point in time, like, for example, 2 weeks after you crashed your car, who would buy auto insurance? You'd be crazy to, even if there's a 30% penalty put on top of that. So the fact of the matter is guaranteed issue sounds good, but it collapses insurance markets. Now, the good news is you actually can cover with people with pre-existing conditions without collapsing insurance markets. We had a high-risk pool here in the state of Wisconsin with a few modifications. I think that would work. Maine actually passed guaranteed issue. It was collapsing the insurance markets. Their premiums doubled and tripled. They put in an invisible high-risk pool, and they cut those premiums in half. So the way you solve the problem is, first of all, know how to solve a problem, which starts with root cause analysis. Recognize, why did these premiums in Wisconsin, for example, on the individual market double and triple? Well, guaranteed issue, community rating, all those market reforms, I'd call them market distortions, have caused premiums to artificially escalate to two or three times what they were prior to Obamacare. You have to acknowledge that reality, focus on it, and then find out, well, what can you do to still achieve those goals so that people with pre-existing conditions can get covered without collapsing insurance markets? And again, the good news is there are some examples. Wisconsin had one of the better functioning high-risk pools. Maine, same situation, were able to cut premiums in half. By the way, when you do that, because the federal government subsidies, the spending is tied to premium levels, you can reduce the spending on the federal government as well. So you've got to figure out exactly what caused this problem, be honest with yourself, recognize the reality, and then enact real reforms that will actually fix the problem. But you've got to be focused on that goal.
Do you think what the House actually was able to pass would still result, as the original CBO forecast said, in 24 million people potentially losing their health care, sir?
Well, you have to analyze exactly what the CBO was saying and how many of those people would voluntarily, if not forced by the federal government under penalty of law.
Or forced by not being able to pay for it, correct?
And or that as well. I mean, certainly that's been one of my concerns. I've traveled around the state of Wisconsin. With premiums having doubled and tripled, I'm talking to people who always carried health insurance, but because they make a little bit too much money, they don't get subsidies, they're taking a risk. They can't afford the coverage. So that's the damage I want to focus on. I want to repair that while still trying to, achieve the goals of what Obamacare is trying to do, trying to bend the cost curve down. Obamacare didn't do that, I don't believe, not in any meaningful way, not long term, and not allow people to keep health insurance that they could afford. Make health insurance more affordable, but the best way of doing that is really looking at how do you make healthcare more affordable, and I would argue there, the same way you make every other product in America within free market competition more affordable, introduce those disciplines of a free market competitive situation.
As I drove to the convention this morning, I heard a national news story that the first meeting of the healthcare group was pretty contentious. I assume you were there. How would you describe it, sir?
Oh, no, I wouldn't call it contentious in the slightest. No. What we have right now in the Republican Conference of the Senate is 52 Republican senators that want to fix this problem. I think it's very collegial. Now, are there differences of opinion? Do we have
yes.
a broad spectrum? Absolutely. You saw that in the House. That's just reality. The best way to break through that disconnect or the differences of opinion is with real information. Coming from the private sector, I'm in manufacturing. I solved a lot of problems. There's a process. lay out a reality. We need information, root cause analysis. Based on that reality, you have to establish achievable goals. Once you've gone through that process, now you can start arguing over the strategies, in this case legislation, that will achieve those goals. What you find in Washington, D.C., you're always operating at the tactical level. People start arguing policy before they have any of the information whatsoever. So they're talking past each other. So what I'm trying to bring into that group is my problem-solving background, a discipline that's going to demand real information. I don't really care about hearing your policy position until you can show me how your solution is actually going to accomplish the goals that I'm establishing, not pull the rug out from under anyone, and start bringing down those premiums so that the subsidy levels would also just naturally come down under Obamacare. This could be a win-win situation if we do it right. Might take a little bit more time than, you know, even I'd like to take on this, but I want to take the time and I want to get it right.
Okay, let's talk about a new subject. President Trump released a very broad, non-specific outline on his changes to our tax structure. My question is someone that is always worried about the deficit. You've heard the projections that it would add $6, $7, $8 trillion with a T. How real are those projections that you're going to significantly boost the deficit, sir?
Well, first of all, I want to find out and probably get a number of different scores from a number of different economists and foundations. Every one of them uses a different model. I think, personally, the goal to particularly business tax reform, corporate tax reform, is on a static basis. In other words, not even taking into account the behavioral differences of different tax rates.
Is that bringing down the rate from 35 to
15? On a static basis, we want to see a lot of revenue loss, hopefully made up for by economic growth, so then a dynamic scoring, you come as close to revenue neutral as possible. I mean, that ought to be the goal to scoring here. Now, I really don't know. I don't think the Trump administration's tax proposal has really been scored effectively and by enough people.
Because there aren't details.
You got to find the details. You got to find out exactly, you know, what are the assumptions of the economic model. Now, from my standpoint, I've been very quietly but very tenaciously been floating a different proposal that would tax all corporate income at the ownership level. You know, there are a number of economists, a number of studies say that it's the employees and consumers that pay the corporate tax in higher prices and lower wages. So rather than have employees and consumers pay the corporate tax, why not make the owners pay the tax? This would be a true Warren Buffett tax. Mm-hmm. It's actually getting a fair amount of interest from colleagues really across the political spectrum. So we've had some initial scores, but people keep changing their models. But you know, this is something, from my standpoint, that is really good, you know, paradigm-shifting tax treatment. Now, in case you think it's pretty radical, it's not. 81% of American businesses have their income taxed exactly this way, at the ownership level. Very fair, eliminates the double taxation of dividends, more efficient allocation throughout the economy, completely eliminates the problem of cash being kept overseas. There'd be no barriers whatsoever. And if you really think about it, the way the tax would be paid on this, by the way, would be a 25% backup withholding made by those corporations to the federal government to cover the taxes that are attributed to the owners. But let's say you're a low-income shareholder in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and your tax rate's 10%. Well, $25 has already been paid on $100 worth of income. You'd actually get a refund of $15. So the initial scores have the distribution in terms of the advantage of this very evenly distributed. Actually, low-income people have the better advantage on this thing. So that's why a lot of my colleagues are really intrigued by this concept.
Would your plan bring back any part of the trillions that are now parked offshores?
It would certainly prevent further parking. You're probably going to have to do something. And the administration, I think, is talking about maybe like a 10% one-time deeming and give people maybe up to 8 years time to pay that off. I mean, you're probably going to have to do something with, you know, covering what's happened in the past. But moving forward, there would be no problem with inversions. And oh, by the way, on the entity level, because you're having the owners pay the tax, again, corporate income is going to be taxed at the ownership level. I mean, Warren Buffett will have to pay his high marginal tax rates on it, true Warren Buffett tax. But on the entity level, you know, basically, U.S. corporations being the most competitive in the world. That's a good thing for economic growth.
Having watched your PowerPoints, though, on the deficit, let me ask you this. In its focus on other major issues, has the Trump administration taken its eye off the deficit reduction ball?
I think in the general sense, no, because the Trump administration is really focused on economic growth, which I have repeatedly say is the number one component of a solution. Take a look at what it's emphasizing. First of all, regulatory reform. So we've got a $2 trillion annual regulatory burden. That's what it costs people to comply with federal regulations. That's $14,800 per household per year complying with federal regulations. Again, that's, you know, we feel those costs in higher prices, less opportunities, lower wages and benefits. So, you know, we, for example, I think we passed 14 reductions to regulatory burden with using the Congressional Review Act. You know, we really removed tens of billions of dollars worth of regulatory burden doing that. President Trump announced the one in, two out rule. So his agencies, if they're going to put forward a new regulation, they're going to have to repeal two other regulations. I mean, part of the problem in Washington, D.C. is you just have layer upon layer upon layer of regulations just keep building up on themselves. Kind of like barnacles on the hull of a ship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the solution would be scrape the barnacles off.
Yeah.
What happens is we just put more barnacles on and just slow the ship of state down further. So it really is an emphasis on regulatory reform, obviously pro-growth tax reform. And, oh, by the way, let's utilize our energy resources to keep American workers as competitive as possible as well.
What are the emerging priorities? First, health care, and then changes to the tax structure, and then the infrastructure package? Are those the one, two, three? And
yeah, I mean, they're all top priorities. You know, right now, just the way it's played itself out, we've got health care in our laps right now. The health care markets are, the individual health care markets are collapsing. I mean, we just saw, was it Aetna decided to pull out again? I mean, company after company are just coming out of this market because Obamacare was a miserable failure. It did not achieve its goals. It's done the exact opposite. So, you know, we do have a responsibility to do everything we can to stabilize the insurance markets for 2018. And then I think our whatever legislation we can pass will really be focused, for example, on insurance premiums in 2019 and 2020. Okay. Again, Obamacare is a real mess, and it's not easy to fix. You know, again, we've got a broad spectrum of opinion in terms of what we need to do. So this isn't going to be easy. It's incredibly complex. I mean, just talking about guaranteed issue and pre-existing conditions. Yeah, we could spend an hour, and people, you know, still might be pretty confused by the conversation. So it's very difficult, very complex. It's going to take some time.
In the wake of your, you issued a statement in the wake of the president's dismissal of FBI Director Comey. Very simple, thank you for your service, wishing him well. Do you think he'd lost the confidence of both leaders of both parties in Congress and rank-and-file FBI agents?
Well, I mean, I don't know how many Democrats called for his resignation or for him to be fired. I appreciated my dealings with Director Comey. I think he's a fine man, I think, trying to do a difficult job. I think he was put in a very difficult situation, for example, with what Loretta Lynch did. Really, the behavior of Secretary Clinton. You know, her grotesque use of emails. So he's in a really tough position. He made decisions. And those decisions, his actions were far outside the guidelines and precedent within the Department of Justice. And that made it very difficult for him to continue on. So, you know, I think in the end, it's probably best that we have a new director of the FBI. But again, that's not to take away anything from Director Comey either. I think he was a decent man. I wish him well, which is why I issued a relatively short statement.
In his interview, though, with NBC, the president said that the Russia probe was a factor in why he dismissed Mr. Comey. Are you afraid the FBI is going to be politicized? That's an institution where the director was given 10-year term for a reason.
Yeah, no, I really don't have that fear. Listen, when I ran, I said I would try and work with whoever is the next president, that I would hold whoever is the next president accountable. That's certainly my viewpoint, and I can tell you it's the viewpoint of the Senate Intelligence Committee on a bipartisan basis. I think these are members of the Senate that are working really hard to get to the bottom of this. And, you know, I think the integrity of people throughout the Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, is also impeccable. So, no, we do have checks and balances here. I think maybe our political opponents are getting a little too far ahead of themselves. I think maybe the mainstream press is, you know, getting a little too hysterical about this. And I've got a great deal of faith in the checks and balances established by our founders because I know the people serving in those areas of checks and balances are people of integrity.
You serve on the Homeland Security, and so you're vitally interested in the immigration. That's second, mm-hmm. The revised order. You disappointed that the courts have also invalidated that or put that one on hold, Senator?
I am, because I think it's dangerous. You know, Congress has vested the power of determining who we're going to let in this country pretty much with the president. And the president's power is at its maximum when Congress has passed a law investing power in the president. And the fact that courts are overruled those laws is troubling. You know, particularly when it is really resting on the shoulders of the President of the United States to keep this nation safe and secure. And so I think this is a court overreach, and I am concerned about that. That being said, I am very pleased that this administration, really for the first time since I've been aware, is finally committed to securing the border. That's incredibly important for a host of reasons. If we're going to fix our immigration system, and I want to do so, I put forward, I think, a pretty common sense guest worker program. They'd be governed by the states. It's getting, I think, a lot of attention, a fair amount of support. I mean, that'd be a good thing, but we've got to secure a border before we can fix the immigration system. Public health and safety, on the convention floor here, a number of speeches were talking about this opioid crisis, all these overdoses. Well, it's that supply of heroin coming in and, dramatically lowering prices of heroin, so it's a very affordable, destructive habit. And if I'm concerned about Islamic terrorists coming to this country, I'm pretty concerned about them coming through our poor southern border.
So a long-term federal budget should include funding for that border wall that the president wants, sir?
Border security. We had Secretary Kelly testify before our committee, and he said nobody's envisioning a wall from sea to shining sea. I viewed that wall as a metaphor for a commitment to securing our border with, better barriers. We need far better walls in certain areas, and they work, by the way. But also technology, also, enforcement of the laws. I think we're seeing a dramatic reduction in illegal immigration right now because people are realizing there's a new sheriff in town and we're going to enforce our laws. So why waste their time coming in here when they get apprehended? They're not going to get dispersed. They're going to be sent home. So I think fewer families are making the decision to spend a fortune, their lifetime savings or a year's worth of salary to send their children on a very dangerous journey because they're just going to get sent back. So enforcing the law actually makes an awful lot of sense and can really reduce the amount of illegal immigration. That's a good thing.
Then my final question. In the wake of the dismissal of Mr. Comey, some in Washington, some of the pundits in Washington, not me, are using the term constitutional crisis. Are we approaching or in a constitutional crisis,
Senator? No, not even close. Okay. Again, there are people of real integrity in these various branches of government, in the different agencies, that I think the American people should have a great deal of confidence in. If people in government do wrong, they're going to be held accountable. I think Secretary Clinton was held accountable by the voters with that revelation. Any president cannot violate the law. They cannot exceed their constitutional authority without a check being placed on them. So, again, I'm dedicated to holding whoever is president accountable, and I think most of my colleagues are as well.
Senator Ron Johnson at the Republican State Convention, thanks for your time. I'll let you get back to being convention chairman.
Nice to see you again.
Thank you, sir.